From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We're telling them it's for democracy, it's for liberty, it's for this, it's for that. You know. But when you look at the memos that go back and forth between the State Department and the National Security Council and in the 50s when the United States is first getting involved in Southeast Asia, and the memos are discussing why we are interested in Southeast Asia, what the memos talk about is tin, rubber, and oil.
Renowned historian Howard Zinn talks about the history of government and media lies in a time of war. But first, millions of people are expected to protest around the world on Saturday. But in New York, the Federal Court of Appeals has upheld a ban on the march in Manhattan.
But the demonstration will still go on. People will gather on First Avenue at 49th Street to protest this war against Iraq.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. general will run Iraq. Powell shares details of post-war strategy. This comes a day after Secretary of State General Colin Powell told the House International Relations Committee an American general will run Iraq for at least 2 years. But leaders of Iraq opposition groups who were briefed in Turkey last week by the U.S. said many of the Bush administration's plans are deeply troubling. The post-war Iraq would rely on the current government infrastructure, minus Saddam Hussein, and it would continue the dominance of Arab Sunnis, who represent 10 to 15% of the country's 22 million population. The head of the Kurdish Democratic Party says he's particularly concerned about Washington's agreement to allow Turkey to occupy some Kurdish territory in northern Iraq. The Turkish government has killed thousands of Kurds. Leyla Zana, the Kurdish parliamentarian who dared to speak Kurdish in the Turkish parliament, remains in prison. In other Iraq news, weapons inspectors say Iraq may be in breach of its disarmament obligations because it's developed a missile that slightly exceeds range limits set by the Security Council. The U.S. said the violation proved Iraq is cheating, while the French said it proves inspections work. Tomorrow, Chief Weapons Inspectors Hans Blix and Mohamed El-Bardeh will address the Security Council in an open meeting. Meanwhile, Pope John Paul II's senior advisor has arrived in Baghdad for meetings with senior Iraqi leaders. Last night, he presided over a mass at St. Joseph's Church in central Baghdad. Democracy Now! Jeremy Scahill, correspondent, was there.
Regardless of their faith, Iraqis are praying for a miracle. Almost no one believes that war can be averted, and people of all religions repeat the phrase, "We're asking God to save us." Iraqi Christians came from across Baghdad and beyond to pack the large St. Joseph Cathedral in the center of the capital. For them, it was a rare day of hope in very disparate times. Roger Cardinal Echegaray was saying the Mass. As Pope John Paul II's senior advisor, he's the highest church official to visit Iraq in decades. For several years, the Pope himself has expressed interest in coming to Iraq, but the trip never materialized. Cardinal Echegaray described his trip to Baghdad as a peace mission, and the hundreds of Iraqis at St. Joseph's listened intently to his every word as he delivered a message from the Pope.
Peace. Who doesn't talk about it today everywhere in the world without thinking about the huge threats that weigh on Iraq? Who does not desire peace? But how many among them think that it is still possible? How many truly want it with all their will? Today, this night, here, we pray for peace in Iraq.
After the cardinal finished his prepared statement, he looked out at the congregation, raised his arms, and repeated in Arabic, "Salam, salam, peace, peace." The church erupted with applause and cheering, followed by rhythmic clapping. Cardinal Echegaray's visit to Baghdad hasn't dramatically increased hope that peace will indeed prevail, but it did send a message to Iraq's Christians that they're not forgotten. The Vatican appears to be stepping up its efforts at reaching a peaceful solution to the crisis. Later this week, Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz, himself a Christian, is scheduled to meet the Pope in Rome. John Paul II has added his voice to the growing chorus against a war on Iraq, but it's unlikely that George W. Bush will listen. His own Methodist church has come out against an attack on Iraq, and Bush won't even meet with its leaders. For Democracy Now!, this is Jeremy Scahill in Baghdad.
And you are listening to Democracy Now! The International Atomic Energy Agency yesterday found North Korea in breach of its international commitments and passed the issue to the UN Security Council. This came on the same day the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency warned North Korea may be ready to test an advanced ballistic missile able to reach the western United States. Belgium's highest court ruled yesterday Israeli Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon can be sued for war crimes connected to his role in the Sabra and Shatila massacre, in which up to 2,000 Palestinian refugees were slaughtered. However, Sharon is immune until he leaves office. In response to the ruling, Israel immediately recalled its ambassador to Belgium. The Guardian of London's reporting the U.S. knew about the latest Osama bin Laden tape 5 days before its broadcast on Al Jazeera. The government of Qatar reportedly passed the tape on to Washington. It is unclear whether the U.S. influenced the timing of the broadcast, and if not, why it was delayed until Tuesday. Just 2 days before Space Shuttle Columbia's disintegrated, a safety engineer warned by email about possible catastrophic failures from extreme heat due to malfunctions. No NASA engineers acted on the warning. The Philippine military said today it may have killed as many as 122 members of the Moro Islamic Liberation Front in 3 days of heavy fighting on the southern island of Mindanao. Afghan officials said yesterday a U.S.-led bombing raid in southern Afghanistan killed at least 17 civilians. In Bolivia, the president rescinded a tax hike after at least 14 protesters, including 4 police officers, were shot dead by soldiers in clashes. And in New York, a federal appeals court upheld a lower court ruling that New York's mayor can ban an anti-war march, though not rally, planned for Saturday. The massive rally is set for the United Nations on Saturday. We'll have more in a few minutes.
I'm just an American boy. Raised on MTV and a scene on the kids in the soda pop ends, but none of them look like me. So I started looking around for a light out of the dim, and the first thing I heard that made sense was the word of Muhammad.
Steve Earle, John Walker's Blues here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, breaking the sound barrier. Millions of people on 5 continents are expected to protest against war in Iraq on Saturday. From Antarctica to the Pacific Islands, hundreds of cities and 60 countries will be holding events. The list of rallies, vigils, and marches continues to grow. According to today's Guardian of London, the list currently includes more than 300 cities in Europe and North America, 50 in Asia and Latin America, 10 in Africa, 20 in Australia and Oceania. But in Manhattan yesterday, the Federal Second District Court of Appeals upheld a ban on the march. In Manhattan, organizers are moving forward with plans for a massive legal peace rally that day. We're joined in our studio by Leslie Kagan, who is organizer of this Saturday's event in New York with United for Peace and Justice. She's also chair of the Pacifica Radio Foundation. And Michael Ratner is with us, human rights lawyer and president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. His latest book, along with his colleagues, is Against War with Iraq, an anti-war primer. Welcome both to Democracy Now! So, Leslie, you newly defined the voice of the voiceless.
Yes.
But if you can bear it, can you explain what has happened? What has the federal court ruled?
Well, my understanding, not being a lawyer, and Michael can probably help. Sorry about my voice, folks. But the federal court, the appeals court, basically upheld a decision by a lower court earlier in the week that the city of New York could limit our exercise of free speech just to a permanent rally. We had applied for permits to rally and march, and the city denied the march part of the demonstration. We took them to court, and at 2 levels in the federal court system, they said that the city, and in particular the police department, could, in the interest of, quote, security, limit our free speech rights.
Didn't they use the term in a time of war?
I don't recall them saying particularly. Yes, actually, yesterday they did. In the appeals court, they did use in time of war. And I must say, in this whole process, it does feel like we are in a time of war.
I don't know if people know your history going way back. New York Times did a profile of you recently, but you have been through a lot of these marches, organized the major anti-nuclear march in the 1980s where more than a million people turned out in New York. So
yes.
What happened there? I mean, in terms of the police, they allowed a march.
Yes. I mean, that was a struggle. It's always a struggle. But we won the right to march, not only anywhere in New York, but literally on First Avenue past the UN. This time they said not only could you not march on First Avenue past the UN, but nowhere in Manhattan would they allow a march.
Well, what is the big deal? I mean, if you have a permitted legal rally where hundreds of thousands of people can turn out, why is the issue so critical to be able to march?
It's well, for us, it's important because one of the ways that people express their opposition to this war, and we must not lose the central issue here, it is our opposition to the war against Iraq. And they are in some ways diverting us from that central issue. But the fight for our right to march is also obviously very, very critical. But one of the ways people do that in a march is to gather in different constituency groups, in different contingents. People march as labor, as students, as seniors, et cetera, et cetera. You lose that in a rally. You don't get that sense of the diversity of who's there. You also don't get, it's a less empowering feeling to be penned in. And the city of New York, the police department, will have pens on First Avenue limiting people's movement. It is a much more empowering feeling to be in your contingent, marching with your constituency, literally making your voice heard.
Michael Ratner, can you talk about this from a legal point of view, what the judges have ruled and how unprecedented it is?
Well, my view is it's completely unprecedented. Here we have the critical issue of the day, whether or not we should go to war with Iraq. We have the biggest protest in the United States about to happen in New York. And what do the mayor, the police department, the lower federal court judges, and the upper federal court judges do but say you can have the demonstration, you can have a rally in one concrete place, but you can't march? Unheard of. Major issue of the day, not being able to allow people to engage in public protest. Understand, and it was raised in the court, that 3 or 4 weeks from now, there will be a St. Patrick's Day parade going down Fifth Avenue. A parade, in other words, people marching. Why is that different? Because it's cultural, because it's St. Patrick, or because of the message? Obviously, in this case, in my view, it's because of the message. They don't want the message getting out throughout New York and having a major demonstration in this city right now.
What about the level of harassment that we've been hearing reported at all different levels? Leslie, if you have the voice to talk about this, can you give us some of the examples?
Yes. Well, two examples come to mind immediately is that people, at least one person I know and maybe more, who have been leafleting in the subways of New York have been getting $50 tickets. I've never heard of that before. And also, people outside of New York have been getting calls from the intelligence division of the New York City Police Department, not only asking them how many buses they're bringing, but asking them how long they've been involved, where do they live, what kinds of groups are coming on the buses. We've been very clear to people around the country, and we want to make this clear again, you do not have to answer those questions. You should not answer those questions.
Just this morning, a member of our crew was at Penn Station, and he had a pin on, and the police stopped him and started to question him.
Now, you do not have to answer those questions. I want to reiterate that, and you can just say to the person, I'm not answering the question. Say to the cop, I don't want to answer the questions. You can then say, I have a lawyer, and you can even basically use the name of the Center for Constitutional Rights, tell the cop to call the center and let him talk to us at the center. Believe me, they won't call us.
What about the issue of transportation on Saturday? We've seen the signs in the subways on both the west side and the east side saying that above the protests there will be subway interruptions.
Yes. Well, of course, anybody familiar with the New York subway system knows there's constantly interruptions and construction, et cetera, and some of that will go on. But in our negotiations with the police yesterday afternoon, we said to them, we do not want subways closed. We do not want people who are walking on the streets, on the sidewalks, not in the streets, but gathering in groups and walking on the streets to the rally area to be interrupted. Some buses will be parking at Shea Stadium in Queens and taking the subway in. We want to make sure that subway line is running. They said all of that will function. But I must say, people should not be surprised if they run into some problems in the police department. They have been, well, on the face of it, they're very polite and joking with us, and et cetera. Below that is, I think, a very, very serious commitment to undermine our protest. And we're encouraging people to not let that happen, to make sure you come to the rally site, bring your signs, bring your banners, walk to the rally site on the sidewalk that is permitted, that is legal, and make your voice heard. We're also encouraging people, though, to bring radios, bring portable radios. WBAI here in New York will be broadcasting the rally. We're trying to develop what we call a people sound system so that wherever you are in New York, you will be able to hear the rally.
And, of course, this broadcast that we will be doing on Saturday, Pacifica Station, WBAI, Democracy Now! Will be aired all over the country by Pacifica stations and any station that wants to. And in addition, it is going to be the largest public media collaboration we have seen in this country, because we will be broadcasting from noon until 3, also on television. We'll be broadcasting on DirecTV, WorldLink. We'll be broadcasting on Free Speech TV, which we do every day on Democracy Now! That's channel 9415 of Dish Network. And any public access TV station, you can call and ask them to broadcast the protests. Among the people who will be speaking, who?
Bishop Tutu from South Africa will be speaking. Julian Bond, the chair of the National the NAACP, the largest African-American organization in the country, will be speaking. A whole host of New Yorkers from different constituency groups. The executive vice president of the Communication Workers of America, Larry Cohen, will be speaking. Kim Gandy, the president of NOW, the National Organization of Women, will be speaking. There'll also be music and cultural presentations. It will be a full, dynamic program. The program from the stage is critical, and that will go on. What is also critical is that people not let the courts and the New York City Police Department deter them from being on the streets of New York.
I also just want to say, for any radio station, we hope to be broadcasting from 11 until 4 for the radio stations, 12 to 3 for TV, and so people can tune in then. Michael Ratner, you have written the book Against War with Iraq with your colleagues Jenny Green and Barbara Olshansky of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and anti-war primer. We have seen in the last few days Chuck Lewis put out on his website, Center for Public Integrity, the Justice Department pretty much top secret draft of an expansion of the USA Patriot Act. Now, a two-part question. One is nonstop. In fact, this morning, listening to the radio and watching television, all across the board, and this weekend, pretty much 24 hours a day, and it becomes the icon of the networks. Terror alert, up to the orange alert right below red alert. I almost think that the network should replace terror alert with protest alert.
Yes.
It is very frightening. Today they're talking about preparing every hospital in New York for biological and chemical weapons victims. What is going on here?
Well, I think what you're saying is right. I mean, what's going on here is, as the court itself said, because we're on an orange alert, that's one reason that we don't want this march to happen, because we're in a war, which of course could take 40 years, according to our own government. We don't want this march to happen. So I think there's a huge intimidation going on. And obviously what's going on a deeper level, in my view, is what are we afraid of? What's really going on is we're afraid of the United States right now going to war with Iraq, because if anything's going to make our world less safe, it's going to be that, and not our protests in the street. Our protests in the street and at the demonstration are going to be what makes us safe. And I just want to echo what Leslie said. That Court of Appeals decision should be basically a sign to everybody to get out onto the streets and into that demonstration. We have to show them, if you weren't thinking of going before, you should be there now.
Mm-hmm. One reporter asked at one of your press conferences, United for Peace and Justice, Leslie, listen, you don't think you're going to be heard outside the United Nations? You'll have a gathering and the UN will hear you. What's the issue?
Let me just say, we're thinking of changing our name to United for Peace and Justice and Democracy. The struggle for democracy is central here. There are several issues here. One, again, is that we believe we, the people who are demonstrating, have the right to determine the nature of our demonstration. That's not up to the mayor of the city or the police department to tell us how we can make our voices heard. Two is that we are concerned that if they can shut down a march here, what will they do tomorrow in Des Moines or the next day in Kansas City? That this is part of a national problem that we're facing, and that is the shredding of the Constitution.
Or at the Republican convention here
exactly.
In New York.
Oh, I think that's right, Amy. I think I agree with Leslie. This is really a bad sign of our next years in this country in terms of protest, democracy. You can describe it really what's going on as a police state right now in this city. That's what we have here. We have a police state in this city right now.
What about the expanded USA Patriot Act that John Ashcroft is proposing? Can you go through some of the points that have now come out?
There's two things. One is, it's not chance that right now there was a decision in a New York City court in a case called Hanshu that allows increased government spying. That came down a week ago, and I don't think it's chance that it came down a week ago right before this demonstration, because these guys were prohibited essentially from spying on demonstrations before this decision came down, and now they're allowed to. Now you have an addition, of course, on the federal level. The first thing you have in that new supposed Patriot Act, too, is to wipe out all restrictions on police spying that are in any state of the United States. So to the extent the Hanshu opinion, which still has a little group that meets together to decide on misuse of spying, if this Patriot II goes through, all court federal proceedings, all court orders will be wiped off the map, period, no more. Secondly, you have an amazing ruling in terms of citizenship coming out of here. If one is accused of supporting a terrorist group and one is convicted, which could even mean giving blankets to somebody the U.S. designates as terrorist, you can get your citizenship lost. In fact, you will have your citizenship lost under this. Unheard of, in my view.
What does it mean, citizenship lost?
It means that you won't be a U.S. citizen anymore.
And if you were born here?
No, you're gone. It's not just naturalized citizens.
Where do you go?
That's a good question. Where do you go? You probably go to jail for a very long time. But where do you go after that? Well, I guess, you know, the same place they're planning to maybe put Saddam Hussein if he leaves. You know, I don't know, Amy.
Bus captains, people who are in charge of organizing, how have they been approached?
Well, again, people outside of New York have been called systematically by the police department. We haven't heard reports yet here in New York about organizers of different groups that are coming being directly arrested. But we're assuming that the police are watching very, very closely. And I say that not to frighten people. People need to know what is going on. At the same time, if we don't stand up for our rights now, they will chip away until we have none left. Now is the time to make our voices heard. And now, as the U.S. inches closer and closer to war, we have got to come out in large numbers. And our protests will continue after this weekend. We are not going to be deterred. We will do everything we possibly can to stop this insane drive to war.
Well, Leslie Kagan, chair of the United for Peace and Justice Coalition's protests this weekend in New York, the motto, "The World Says No to War," and Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights, he's president, his book, Against War with Iraq, an Anti-War Primer, with Jenny Green, Barbara Shansky of CCR. Thank you very much. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, Howard Zinn. Stay with us.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground, won't be turned around. And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey, baby, there ain't no easy way out. Hey, I will stand.
I won't back down. Johnny Cash here on Democracy Now!, breaking the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. We go now to historian Howard Zinn, professor emeritus of political science at Boston University, well before that, Spelman College in Atlanta, author of 14 books, including A People's History of the United States, talking about the history of government propaganda and mainstream media propaganda in times of war.
So step back from the immediate, which is hard, right? Because the immediate is what we're seeing on television. The immediate is what they want us to concentrate on. They want to sort of build a wall around Iraq and Saddam Hussein and not look anywhere else in the world and not look back into history. Just now, today, you know, inspections, UN resolutions, Colin Powell's report, weapons of mass, that's what we're supposed to concentrate on. Because it's dangerous to let people look back into history, and it's dangerous to let them extend their vision beyond where you want them to see, beyond, you know, the Iron Curtain. Let's bring back that phrase, the Iron Curtain, which they have built around this little country in the Middle East, and we're not supposed to look anywhere else. When I say they want to, you know who I mean by they. There is a they, right? You know, they are the ones who've taken over our country. Really. Did you ever wake up in the morning and look at the headlines and feel that you live in an occupied country? Really? Really? You know? Yeah. So they are the politicians and the generals and the press, the media, and sometimes the university presidents who have... I don't know why that excited people. But... So I suggest we look a little back into history, a little diversion from the headlines and television and CNN and all of that. And one of the first things, it's not that history can tell us definitively what is right and wrong in a present situation. It can't. There's always a possibility of something unique, right? But history can be suggestive. History can show persistencies, not inevitabilities, but persistencies. It can show probabilities. It can make you skeptical. If you don't know history, it's as if you were born yesterday. And if you were born yesterday, anybody can get up there before the microphone, especially the leaders of the country, the authorities, anybody can get up there before the microphone and tell you, we must go to war for freedom, for democracy, for this, for that, for self-determination, for to, you know, cement our alliances, you know, to win the Super Bowl. There's always, there are reasons. But anybody can get up there and give you any reasons. And if you don't have know any history, you don't have any basis for questioning what they do. So, yes, it's good to go back, and it's good to try to see patterns. One of the patterns you see immediately is that governments lie. I. F. Stone, some of you may remember that great journalist, one of the great journalists of the 20th century, I. F. Stone. He left these establishment newspapers that he worked for and put out his little newsletter, I.F. Stone's Weekly, and he would tell you things that you couldn't read anywhere else. And his little newsletter became, rather famous for getting information that you couldn't get anywhere else. And he would be, after a while, invited to schools of journalism, and he'd speak to young people who are going to be journalists, and he would say, look, whatever else you remember from what I say, just remember two words. Governments lie. Good starting point for any citizen. Because what you find when you go back, especially when you go back to the history of wars and military interventions, you find a pattern of deception and lies, going all the way back and coming down to the present, Let's go back to the Mexican War. I'm doing that because nobody goes back to the Mexican War. And I'd like to do something fresh and different. The Mexican Wars, some of you may remember it. Some of you may have been there. 1846. President Polk said, I have to read his words because, they're good. as we're about to go to war with Mexico, right? The cup of forbearance has been exhausted. It sounded familiar to me, except that the language now is not as elegant. You know, now Bush is saying, oh, we can't wait. You know, I would welcome some really elegant language like the cup of forbearance has been exhausted. No, we're not getting that, you see. Then he said, American blood has been shed on American soil. Well, actually, nobody knew what had happened there on that border between the Nueces River and the Rio Grande River in 1846, a clash between American soldiers and Mexican soldiers, disputed territory, not exactly American soil. But who knows? You know, the president tells you something, you aren't there. Okay, we're ready to go. Now, of course, there were other motives. It wasn't just that there'd been a clash, right? In fact, you know, before the Mexican War started, Polk had confided to his diary, we need war with Mexico. He probably said it more elegantly than I'm saying it now, because in those days, people just spoke more elegantly. You know, even the bad guys spoke well. You see, now the bad guys speak badly. But of course, the real motives were the United States simply wanted Mexican territory. And when the war ended, we took, you know, like 40 to 50% of Mexican land. In California, beautiful land. Arizona, New Mexico. Now we don't want them to come back into old Mexican territory. Now we build walls and set up barbed wire and have immigration guards to keep them from the territory we stole from them in 1848. But, you know, that's the way things work, you know, in the world of international crime. So, yeah, lies and deception. There's the Spanish-American War. Do you remember? 1898, Spanish-American War. And again, a precipitating event, you know, in the Mexican War, a clash on the border. In the Spanish-American War, the battleship Maine has blown up. Well, a terrorist act. They've done it to us. Nobody asked, hey, what was our battleship Maine doing in Havana Harbor? Have you noticed that when something happens to one of our things, one of our destroyers or the USS Cole or, you know, off the coast of Yemen or somewhere like that, you know, and something happens to it and the question is who did it and why and where are they? And nobody asks, what were we doing there? And so nobody asks, what was the battleship Maine doing in Havana Harbor? But it blew up. Obviously, Spain did it. Well, there was no proof that Spain did it, but you don't need proof, you say. And so it's one of those precipitating events that's nice to have when you want to go to war. Because it turned out later, many, many, many years later, in fact, not until the 60s or 70s, that an investigating commission was set up under Admiral Rickover, and they discovered that the battleship Maine was blown up by a defect in the engine room. A little late, you say. But so we went into Cuba. We also said not only did the battleship Maine blow up to make us angry, but we also needed to liberate the Cubans from Spain, because this is what we do. We liberate people. And so we liberated Cuba from Spain. In fact, we did. It's true. But we didn't liberate Cuba from ourselves. We got Spain out, and we got American corporations in. American railroads, American banks, American investments, United Fruit, you know, all of that, you know. Shortly after the Spanish-American War, we find that we have naval vessels and troops in the Philippines. Cuba is close. The Philippines is far. Hardly anybody knows where they are. When you talk about them, people think they must be off the coast of San Francisco. No, they're not. They're really far away, the Philippines. Say. At this point, in 1899, shortly after the Spanish-American War, the Secretary of War, Elihu Root, says, the American soldier is different from all other soldiers of all other countries since the world began. He is the advance guard of liberty and justice, of law and order, and of peace and happiness. It's comforting to read that, if you knew nothing else. Is it 1899? But the American soldiers are in the Philippines, and there follows from 1899 for the next several years a long and bloody war to conquer the Philippines, in which almost a million Filipinos are killed, in which massacres take place, in which atrocities take place, in which 600 Moros in the southern Philippine island are totally wiped out, men, women, and children, by an American regiment commanded by a general. And after that happens, Theodore Roosevelt congratulates the general for a great military victory, leading Mark Twain to comment acidly about Theodore Roosevelt and that great military victory. But no, our soldiers are different. It's always this business of America is different. We're hearing that today. You know, we are different. If we are going to be an imperial power, we're going to be a different imperial power. We're not going to be like England and Belgium and France and Germany and all the other imperial powers. No. America is different. Except that when you look at what we do after we parade our claim of difference, you find that we behave as all the other imperialists behave. We lie and we commit atrocities. Now, even, I didn't quite expect it from him, but Kipling said at one point, if any question why we died, tell them, because our fathers lied. These are not little lies. These are lies that lead to deaths. These are lies that lead to huge numbers of deaths. And so the march of lies, the march of deception, goes on as we get into war after war. You know, it happens in World War I. Presumably we're going into, that war to... Why? To save the world, for democracy, to the war, to end all wars. Or we're going in just because the submarines are attacking merchant vessels. Well, of course, when somebody introduces a resolution in Congress suggesting that we should withdraw our merchant vessels from the area, oh no, American honor is involved. Let's keep the merchant vessels going. We need... Well, they didn't say that. It would be good to have the merchant vessels there. It would be good to have reason to go to war. And so we entered that slaughterhouse, which was Europe in 1917, a war in which 10 million people died. 10 million soldiers died, 10 million civilians died of the after effects of malaria after the war. But after that, people looked around and asked, what in the world were we fighting for? What was it all about? Lies and deceptions again and again. You know, and if you move, more recently, of course, Vietnam. Read Daniel Ellsberg's memoir of his life in the United States, State Department, Defense Department, U.S. Marines, Rand Corporation, and then his departure from that. And his release of these top-secret documents which reveal American lies. But in his book, Secrets, he tells you very specifically all the instances in which the government of the United States lied. Not just Republicans, Democrats, lying is bipartisan. And this goes on. and always claims made. You know, what did we claim that we were in Vietnam for? Well, to stop communism. Sort of, if somebody thought for a minute, we're worried that this little piece of Southeast Asia, this little peninsula, is going to go communist. That'll be a really terrifying thing. Just north of that, 1 billion people have just gone communist, right? But no. Well, the truth is, precisely because 1 billion people have just gone communist, we really want a little corner of Southeast Asia where we can have troops, where we can have a base. We need bases. Although we're telling the world, and certainly telling the American people that we're there for all sorts of reasons, self-determination of the Vietnamese, sort of an ironic thing. In order for the Vietnamese to have self-determination, we are sending 500,000 troops over there. We're telling them it's for democracy, it's for liberty, it's for this, it's for that. You know. But when you look at the memos that go back and forth between the State Department and the National Security Council and in the 50s when the United States is first getting involved in Southeast Asia, and the memos are discussing why we are interested in Southeast Asia, what the memos talk about is tin, rubber, and oil. Well, that's not what the public is told, tin, rubber, and oil. That's embarrassing. To think that we are going to be in a war for years and years and years and kill lots of people and have lots of our own people killed for tin, rubber, and oil. You're not supposed to talk about that.
Howard Zinn, historian, speaking at the New School in New York just two nights ago. We're going to come back to that speech in just a minute. But if you are going to be at a protest anywhere this weekend, we would like to ask you to email us your name, your cell phone number, and what city you'll be in. We're going to be covering protests around the country and the world in our national broadcast on Saturday from the New York major demonstration. The world says no to war. Our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. That's mail at democracynow.org. Also, tell us what you're doing in this time of war. You can call us. We'll be playing comments, 212-209-2999, 212-209-2999. Just back in a moment.
Far between sundown's finish and midnight's broken tone, we ducked inside the doorway, thunder crashing. As majestic bells and phones struck shadows in the sound, seeming to be the chimes of freedom flashing. Flashing for the warriors whose strength is not to fight. Flashing for the refugees on the unarmed road of flight. And for each and every underdog soldier in the night. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing.
You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. By the way, we're looking for volunteers to help us at the rally on Saturday. Please email us at Karen, K-A-R-E-N, at democracynow.org. Back to historian Howard Zinn speaking at New School University on Tuesday night.
At one point, President John F. Kennedy said, Vietnam is an important piece of real estate. Well, and American people didn't say this, you know, in a public address. So there was what was told to the public was one thing, and what the reality was, you know, was something else. And so we still have this pattern. We have precipitating events. Of course, in the Vietnam case, the precipitating event was the Gulf of Tonkin incident in the summer of 1964. You know, they fired on our, right, destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin. Again, where is the Gulf of Tonkin? And what are our destroyers doing in the Gulf of Tonkin? No, nobody asked that question, but they fired on our, of course, it turns out, to be full of lies. I mean, I think McNamara made one statement about the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and in that one statement, there were like four separate lies. That's an achievement. So Yeah, precipitating incidents. Even when we invaded Panama, which hardly anybody remembers because, you know, it's no big deal, right? It's just Panama. It's virtually ours. I mean, we can do what we want with Panama. And you know, so what? How many people died? Not a lot, maybe 1,000 or 2,000. Some neighborhoods destroyed, a lot of people displaced. But it's something you do very quickly and get rid of because, there was some precipitating event, as I recall, had something to do with an American sergeant who was insulted by a Panamanian. I don't know. One of those very shadowy, you know, and our honor was at stake. You know, and of course, what we said we were doing, we were going after Noriega, this drug person, right? The man who was responsible for the drug trade there. Because as you know, the United States government has always been against the drug trade, except when it was involved in the drug trade, you know. And so that mayhem was done in Panama, and sure enough, Noriega is captured, and he's put on trial, and so on. And then it's forgotten about. And then we have the Gulf War. And again, why are we going to the Gulf War? Because Kuwait has been taken over by Iraq. And in fact, this is true. I mean, some of these precipitating events are real. This was real. Kuwait really was taken over by Saddam Hussein. But the real question is that why we went to war? Do we go to war every time one country invades another country? No, we had lots of invasions of one country by another country. We haven't gone to war. There must have been something special about Kuwait. Could have been the oil. Hard to believe that. Hard to believe we'd go to war over oil. But it's also hard to believe that the Bush senior was so heartbroken over the invasion of Kuwait that he decided something must be done. You know, his compassion led us into war. A war in which we don't know how many people were killed in the Gulf War. The casualty lists were never counted. The reporters were not allowed to watch what was going on. The massacres of Iraqi troops who were retreating from Kuwait and gunned down and buried by American machinery buried alive into these graves. I mean, these things, reporters were not allowed to see what was happening. Huge numbers of people were killed in this war, presumably for the freedom of Kuwait. And then, of course, came the sanctions, and then hundreds of thousands of more people dead as a result of that. So it must have been something more than Kuwait. I said, and there too, you know, the history of American policy in the Middle East suggests that American policy in the Middle East has been dominated by one concern ever since the end of World War II, ever since President Roosevelt met with Ibn Saud, the Saudi Arabian monarch, and they met in 1945, and they came to some kind of deal where, okay, the United States is going to become the big player in the oil fields of the Middle East, and in return, the Saudi monarchy is going to be protected by American power, which American power, in fact, has done since then, no matter how brutal this monarchy is. I mean, you talk about tyranny. You talk about the treatment of women. I mean, Saudi Arabia is a classic example. You talk about torture, you talk about executions, but no, we made a promise to Saudi Arabia, and we're keeping it because of oil. So today, there's no precipitating event. It would be easier for the Bush administration to go to war if there were a precipitating event. They may find one. You know, something may happen. But they don't need one. They don't need anything. They're determined to go to war. That's obvious, isn't it? You see the news items over and you go back. Look, they have to agree to inspections. Okay, they agreed to inspections. They had better agree that we can inspect the palaces. Okay, you can inspect the palaces, you know. And one after one, of course, you can understand the Iraqis doing this, not because, you know, they're, you know, lovely, the government is, you know, cooperative and beautiful. No, you know, they don't want to be attacked by the United States. And so the latest thing, the United States has demanded that it be allowed to have U-2 flights over Iraq. Okay, they say yes. No, it's not. Nothing is enough. The Bush administration is determined to go to war. Its only problem is that there are a huge number of people in the world who are determined to stop that. And it's a race to see whose determination is going to win out in the end. We may not have the time. Let me say something else about the use of history in order to understand what's going on now. I really expect us to go to war. I don't think it's inevitable, but I think it's very, very likely. And we have to be prepared for that. Even as we not stop our efforts to build up a huge anti-war movement, must never accept war as inevitable if it hasn't started yet. And we've never had an anti-war movement that has moved as fast, grown as fast as this one in the United States in this time, before even the war, you know, has started. Never had such an experience. But I think we ought to be prepared. Almost in a sense, almost everything I have to say to you is a way of saying, because we have an enormous job of education and information to do. We have an enormous job of speaking to our fellow citizens, to our people in the workplace, to people in our neighborhood, to wherever we can. We have an enormous job of spreading information that they can't get from the Bush administration and from the TV networks. And so I guess I'm talking to you and saying, you know, this is what we have to do. We have to reach out beyond the present, and we have to break down that wall that surrounds Iraq and look what happened before. Look what happened in Vietnam. Look what happened in the first Gulf War. Look around. Look what's happening in the rest of the world. I suggest something else. That one of the things we can learn from history, so as to be prepared when this war does start, be prepared for the claims, because it's going to be the most intensive bombing in history. You know that. The idea is to try to save as many American lives as possible. In order to save as many American lives as possible, you have to kill as many Iraqis as possible. You have to send the missiles into Baghdad, you know, in the first few days in the greatest barrage of destruction that has been seen in any war. And and what you will hear again and again, because there will be reports, despite the attempt of the administration to control the news, there will be reports coming through about people being killed, not just soldiers, not just the, you know, the elite guard, and no, just ordinary people, men, women, and children. Reports are going to come through. And then Rumsfeld will get up before the television, or Bush will get up before the television if they let him. And they'll say, well, we're sorry. We didn't mean it. It was an accident. Because you'll hear this again and again. This is an accident, and that's an accident, and the other is an accident, and the accidents will pile up. When the accidents pile up enough, you begin to suspect, you know, that the nation is accident-prone. And you'll begin to think about whether it really is an accident. I was a bombardier in the Air Force, and so since then I've always been interested in bombing. I've always been interested in the claims of we have smart bombs. We only bomb military targets. This is an accident. When civilians are killed in bombing, it is not an accident. By that, I don't mean that the pilot goes out and searches for civilians and deliberately kills civilians, although sometimes that happens. But I mean that when you bomb, no matter how smart the bombs, and don't let them kid you about the smartness of bombs, smart bombs are sent by dumb people. And they're given coordinates to bomb by dumb intelligence agents. But these are not accidents, because when you bomb, you inevitably kill large numbers of innocent people. Inevitably. If it's inevitable, it's not an accident. If it's inevitable, you cannot claim innocence. You cannot claim, you have to accept this because we didn't mean it. But you're going to hear that again and again, have to be prepared for that again and again, and have to be prepared to explain to people. And it's not hard to explain to people that if you drive a car at 80 miles an hour down a street crowded with children, and children die, and you say, I didn't mean to kill any children. No, you can't. No, that cannot be accepted. And they will tell you, we only bomb military targets, which is a lie. Of course, the two elements to that lie, one is they don't only bomb military targets, and two is they have strange definitions about what military targets are. For instance, Harry Truman said, really, Hiroshima was a military target. Really. Hiroshima was a military target. They think that all they have to do is declare something a military target, and it's a military target, you know. And so you have to be very careful about, you know, what a military target is. And a military target is, this sewage treatment plant, this electrical system, all these things that if they're destroyed will lead to the deaths of people, will lead to hospitals not being able to function, with babies dying when they don't have to die. But these are considered military targets.
Howard Zinn, historian, speaking at New School University just a few nights ago. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a video or audio copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. Our email address, mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. That's mail at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Say there's trouble here, trouble everywhere. Lord, I would go home, but there's